Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
It is 12 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We must never lose sight of the tremendous toll this growing conflict is taking on civilians. And we cannot look away from systematic violations of international humanitarian law. This deadly cycle of tit-for-tat violence must stop. Time is running out.
The UN Secretary General calls for peace in the Middle East as Israel bombs a health center in downtown Beirut while threatening to launch a major attack on Iran. We'll go to Beirut for the latest and look at the new Fault Lines Al Jazeera documentary, Starving Gaza.
I don't think anyone in North Gaza has enough food to eat. We have a new malnutrition case. The number of cases is beyond the malnutrition clinic's capacity.
And as the death toll from Hurricane Helene nears 200, we look at how six plastic factory workers are feared dead after floodwater swelled around their workplace in Tennessee. Their boss had reportedly threatened to fire anyone who left during the storm. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least nine people, including health and rescue workers, have died in central Beirut after Israel bombed an apartment building housing a medical center affiliated with Hezbollah. At least 14 people were wounded in the airstrike on the Bashurta district of Beirut near Lebanon's parliament. There are reports Israel fired white phosphorus munitions during the attack. Israel also carried out numerous strikes in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Lebanese authorities say 1.2 million people have been displaced since Israel began its massive aerial assault last week. Eight Israeli soldiers have been killed in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah claims it's destroyed three Israeli tanks. Israel launched the ground invasion days after assassinating Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah Friday. Lebanon's top diplomat has revealed Israel targeted Nasrallah after he'd agreed to a 21-day ceasefire. Foreign Minister Abdullah Abu Habib made the comment during an interview with Christiane Amanpour on CNN.
Are you saying Hassan Nasrallah had agreed to a ceasefire just moments before he was assassinated?
He agreed, yes. We agreed completely. Lebanon agreed to ceasefire, but consulting with Hezbollah, the speaker, Mr. Berri, consulted with Hezbollah, and we informed the Americans and the French that what happened.
So,
and they told us that Mr. Netanyahu also agreed on the statement that was issued by both presidents.
Hezbollah has not confirmed a ceasefire deal was reached, but Lebanon's ambassador to the UK, Rami Mortada, told the BBC, quote, "We were on track trying to discuss a diplomatic alternative to the current abyss, but the hotheads in Israel chose a different path," unquote. Meanwhile, the Emir of Qatar has accused Israel of committing a, quote, "collective genocide," unquote, as he condemned Israel's ongoing attacks on Gaza and Lebanon. This comes as Israel continues to threaten to launch a major attack on Iran after Tehran fired some 180 ballistic missiles at Israeli military bases and other security sites. On Wednesday, President Biden said he supports Israel's right to retaliate, but that he opposes strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. At the United Nations, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield stressed U.S. support for Israel.
As President Biden emphasized following yesterday's attack, The United States is fully, fully, fully supportive of Israel.
On Wednesday, Iran's new president, Masoud Pezeshkian, visited Qatar, where he said Iran wants peace, not war.
The security of the region is the security of all Muslims, and we do not want any war or bloodshed. Since I assumed the presidency, every speech I've made has emphasized our quest for peace and security. No nation or region can prosper in the midst of war. We were left with no choice but to respond. If Israel decides to retaliate, then it will face harsher reactions.
In Gaza, Israeli ground and air attacks have killed nearly 100 people over the last day, including at least 51 in Khan Yunis. The dead in Khan Yunis included 7 women and 12 children. Residents described the Israeli attack.
We were at home when we heard explosions and planes. We could not leave our homes. We wanted to go out to a safe place, like the city by the sea or Mawasi, but we could not get there because of the planes. Whoever left her home was killed because of the quadcopters. There was heavy fire all night. It started from 7 p.m. until 3:30 a.m. nonstop.
Gaza authorities say Israel's year-long war has wiped 902 entire families off the civil registry. There are another 1,364 families where only one family member has survived. The official death toll in Gaza has reached nearly 41,800, but that's believed to be a vast undercount. Federal prosecutors, led by special counsel Jack Smith, have laid out new evidence about how Donald Trump, quote, resorted to crimes to try to stay in office, unquote, after losing the 2020 election. In the filing, Smith argues that Trump should not be protected by presidential immunity since the actions he took were done in his capacity as a candidate. The filing states, quote, at its core, the defendant's scheme was a private one. He extensively used private actors on his campaign infrastructure to attempt to overturn the election results and operated in a private capacity as a candidate for office, unquote. Part of the filing reveals new details about Trump's response to the January 6th insurrection. When an aide told him Vice President Mike Pence's life was in danger, Trump responded by saying, "So what?" When one of Trump's attorneys said his claims of election fraud would not stand up in court, Trump responded by saying, "The details don't matter." President Biden's ordered the Pentagon to deploy 1,000 active duty troops to help with flood relief efforts as the death toll from Hurricane Helene reaches 190. Hundreds remain missing and are feared dead. Power outages and water shortages remain rampant across 6 southeastern states. On Wednesday, Vice President Kamala Harris surveyed storm damage in Augusta, Georgia, where residents have struggled for nearly a week to secure food, water and electricity. Harris toured a Red Cross relief center and spoke to reporters from in front of a home with a fallen tree on its roof.
I am here to personally take a look at the devastation, which is extraordinary. And it is particularly devastating in terms of the loss of life that this community has experienced, the loss of normalcy, and the loss of critical resources.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said Wednesday the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, does not have the funds to make it through the rest of the hurricane season. President Biden said he may call Congress back early from its October recess to take up the issue. Meanwhile, 2 separate rapid attribution studies have found global heating is to blame for Hurricane Helene's ferocity, boosting the storm's top wind speeds and increasing the amount of rain that fell across Georgia and the Carolinas by as much as 50%. Meanwhile, 36 million people across the western United States are under heat advisories today, with forecasters predicting record temperatures of up to 25 degrees above normal. Phoenix, Arizona reached 113 degrees Fahrenheit on Tuesday, the hottest October day in its history, coming after Arizona logged its hottest summer on record this year. The federal government's most recent national climate assessment found the number of heat waves that major U.S. cities are experiencing each year has doubled since the 1980s due to climate change driven by human activity. The United Kingdom has announced it'll return sovereignty over the Chagos Islands to Mauritius after nearly six decades of British rule. The archipelago, located in the Indian Ocean, is home to a contested military base on the island of Diego Garcia, controlled by the UK and leased to the U.S. military. As part of the agreement announced today, the base will remain under UK and U.S. control for at least the next 99 years. In the 1960s and 70s, the UK expelled most Chagos Islands inhabitants to make way for the airbase, which Human Rights Watch has called a crime against humanity. Chagosians seeking to return to their ancestral territory are calling on the Biden administration to apologize and to make reparations. Mexico's newly inaugurated president has issued an historic apology for the Tlatelolco massacre. It was October 2, 1968, when hundreds of students were gunned down by Mexican soldiers as they held peaceful protests on the eve of the Mexico City Olympic Games. On Wednesday, as one of her first official acts, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum signed a decree apologizing for the massacre 56 years ago.
Personally, to me, this is an obligation today. I've said on other occasions that I'm a daughter of the 1968 movement. My mother participated in the student movement. She was a professor at the Instituto Politécnico Nacional. She participated throughout the whole movement as a professor and helping students.
And in California, authorities have indicted 68 members of a neo-Nazi group affiliated with the Aryan Brotherhood known as the Peckerwood Gang. The group, which is based in the San Fernando Valley region, is accused of drug smuggling, robbery and fraud to finance their actions. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. At least nine people, including health and rescue workers, have died in central Beirut after Israel bombed an apartment building housing a medical center affiliated with Hezbollah. At least 14 people were wounded. The attack occurred without warning in the Bashura district of Beirut, near Lebanon's parliament and the United Nations headquarters in the city. There are reports Israel fired white phosphorus munitions during the attack. Israel also carried out numerous strikes in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Lebanese authorities say 1.2 million people have been displaced by the Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, Israel has announced eight of its soldiers were killed in southern Lebanon, which Israel invaded earlier this week.
This comes as Israel continues to threaten to launch a major attack on Iran after Tehran fired some 180 ballistic missiles at Israeli military bases and other security sites. Israel's also killed nearly 100 people in Gaza over the past day. Meanwhile, the Emir of Qatar has accused Israel of committing a, quote, collective genocide, unquote, as he condemned Israel's ongoing attacks on Gaza and Lebanon. Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani made the comment during the Asia Cooperation Dialogue Summit in Doha.
It has become clear that what is happening is collective genocide. In addition to turning the Gaza Strip into an area unfit for human habitation in preparation for displacement, we call for serious efforts for a ceasefire and stop of the attacks carried out by the Israeli occupation on Lebanese territory. Security will not be achieved without achieving a just peace, and this will not be achieved in our region except by establishing an independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital on the borders of June 4, 1967.
For more on all of this, we're joined by Nadim Houri, Lebanese researcher, international lawyer, executive director of the Arab Reform Initiative. He worked at Human Rights Watch for over a decade, where he established the group's Lebanon office and covered the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. He's joining us now from Paris. Nadim, welcome to Democracy Now! Though you are in France right now, you have close connections to people on the ground in Lebanon. Israeli airstrikes hit an apartment building in central Beirut overnight in an area considered a safe zone given its Christian majority population. Can you talk about what you're hearing from people on the ground, what the situation is right now with, 1.2 Lebanese displaced as well?
Sure. Thank you for having me. The offices of the research center I run is actually less than 100 meters away from where the strike happened last night, so I'm very familiar with the area. The overwhelming feeling today in Lebanon is fear, anxiety, and anger for a number of reasons. Fear because the Lebanese have seen what Israel can do to the country since 1978, repeated invasions, repeated attacks, the destruction of the 2006 war, and they've also seen recently what happened to Gaza. There's also a high level of anger because they feel this is a war that they don't understand. This is a war that many of them feel was imposed on them. They feel that there could have been a ceasefire in Gaza, which would have prevented all of this. But also anger at a totally absent Lebanese state. Many people are actually still sleeping on the streets, many of the displaced, because the Lebanese government was unable to really put together a proper evacuation plan. And people who are being hosted either through family or friends or through really a wonderful solidarity movement across the country.
So, Nadeem, could you explain where exactly these displaced people are going? They're sleeping in cars, as you'd said earlier, as well as in being taken in by friends or family in houses. But where in Beirut? Are there places in Beirut that are still considered safe, or are they all leaving the city?
Sure. So people started moving initially from the border villages in the south a month ago. But really, the movement accelerated in the last 10 days, notably on September 23rd, where Israel in one day killed more than 500 Lebanese, which was the highest death toll in Lebanon since the civil war, which ended in 1990. Since then, more than a million people have moved. They've moved. They're being housed by friends, but also the Lebanese government has opened now all public schools. So all public schools are being turned into temporary shelter in Beirut, but also all across the country in Mount Lebanon, in southern cities like Sidon and Tyre. The only problem right now is Israel is increasingly threatening villages and towns further north from its border. Some of the warnings of the last 2 or 3 days go way north of the Litani River, which Israel often talks about, and includes some of the major towns around Tyre, the biggest city in the south.
Nadeem, you mentioned earlier that the Lebanese government has not been able to come up with a proper evacuation plan, that the state is really not functional. If you could describe what the situation was in Lebanon prior to the Israeli attacks and its invasion, both in terms of the economy, but also the government.
Sure. I mean, Lebanon has been in a state of protracted political crisis for years, some would say for decades, but it really accelerated since 2018. And in 2019, we had a major breakdown of the banking system. It turns out that our corrupt elites were basically running a Ponzi scheme. And since 2019, Lebanese don't have access to their savings in the bank accounts. They are allowed $200, $300 a month, depending on how much money they have in these bank accounts. We haven't had a president now for, I think, over a year and a half. So it's only a caretaker government. It's really a state that has, in a way, not only become failed, but has almost given up. They almost act as a postal box for messages between different regional and international parties. And the Lebanese really feel that. They felt it particularly. We have to remember after the Beirut port explosion on August 4th, 2020, where there again, the Lebanese woke up to see large parts of their capital destroyed and learning that many of their politicians knew that ammonium nitrate was being stored in the port right by the city center, and no one did anything. I think there's a strong effort of local organizing right now. And I would add maybe perhaps to one of the challenges facing the displaced is in 2006, Hezbollah's logistics operation was a very well-oiled machine. They were very present. Since the Beeper attacks that Israel had done against Hezbollah members, And many of those members, by the way, were not combatants, but were actually civilians somehow affiliated with Hezbollah. Hezbollah has not been able, through its various associations and services, to really fully support as well those displaced from the south.
Nadim, during Israel's last invasion of Lebanon in 2006, you were at Human Rights Watch in Lebanon, looked into the reasons for civilian deaths there. You tweeted earlier this week, you're, quote, very worried there are the same patterns developing now. I'm wondering if you can comment on this. And you also posted a series of comments on X Wednesday in response to what you call, quote, murmurs amongst Israelis and their supporters in the West and our region about creating a new Middle East. You write, don't do it. You've tried before, and each time it's ended in disaster. Elaborate on all of these points.
Sure, yes. Thank you very much for the opportunity. So I spent 33 days in 2006 of the entire war documenting why Lebanese civilians were being killed. And there were really two main reasons which we're actually finding again today in Lebanon. The first one is that Israel deliberately treats anyone and anything remotely affiliated with Hezbollah, even if they're clearly civilian, as a legitimate target, which is clearly something that international law rejects. And that's why, for example, we saw the attack last night on a medical center. There is no allegation by Israel so far that they've hit any military object other than to say, well, it was a medical center affiliated with Hezbollah. That's clearly illegal. We saw a lot of these attacks in 2006, and we're seeing many of these attacks today in 2024. That's why we actually have now more than 20 medics in Lebanon who've been killed. A number of them have been affiliated with Hezbollah. I should note, there are some accounts that indicate that Hezbollah is, obviously, we know it's not just an armed group. They have various civilian offices, services. It's probably the second biggest employer in Lebanon after the state, you know, probably with more than 100,000 employees. So if you can consider all of them legitimate, like Israel has been tempted to do, you can just imagine the carnage and the crimes that will be committed. And the second main reason of such a high death toll is really what actually the Israeli leadership called in 2006 the Dahiyah Doctrine, Dahiyah being the southern suburb of Beirut, where basically Israel decides to use massive and disproportionate force on civilian areas and civilian objects where Hezbollah could be supported as a way of kind of getting collective punishment and of deterring and frankly trying to push the population to say, okay, we give up. Now, we're seeing these same patterns. We're seeing these same patterns in the last 10 days with the intensification of attacks on Dahiyeh, and that explains why we're seeing such high civilian death tolls. Which brings me to my second point. You know, with these attacks, we started hearing, particularly after the assassination of the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, but also after Iran strikes, we saw a number of Israeli politicians, including Naftali Bennett, who's the former Israeli prime minister, saying, this is our chance to remake the Middle East. You know, but we've heard this before, for those of us who are from the region. We heard this in 1982 when Israel invaded Beirut to push out the PLO, and they tried to install a president and a regime in Lebanon that would be friendly to them. You know what? How this ended, other than the massacres and the crimes, it ended with the creation of Hezbollah. We heard that in 2006 again when they said, you know, we're going to go in and we're going to destroy Hezbollah and this will be the end of it. Hezbollah came out stronger than before. And in 2008, Hezbollah used that strength to actually control Lebanon even more by using some of its weapons against other Lebanese. The U.S. made the same mistake in 2003. They invaded Iraq and they said, you know, we're going to refashion the Middle East into our own, you know, into what we would like to see, into these pro-Western governments. And that has been an utter failure. And the U.S. is about to leave Iraq. You know, the problem is with all these strategies, all these campaigns, is we know that this overwhelming use of force cannot change people's agency. The region does not want to be a satellite of Israel or a satellite of the U.S. And by the way, the region does not want to be a satellite of Iran either. The problem is the region is not really being given much of a choice. And that's what's happening in Lebanon and Palestine and so many other places.
Well, let's go, Nadim, to comments made by Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who said on Wednesday that Israel should take out Iran's nuclear program. He was speaking on CNN.
Sometimes history knocks on your door and you got to seize the moment. If we don't do it now, I don't see it ever happening. And now is the moment. I also want to explain why. Because Iran's strategy, it had two arms that were sort of defending it, or they were its insurance policy against an Israeli strike, and that's Hezbollah and Hamas. But those two arms are temporarily paralyzed. So it's like a boxer out in the ring without arms for the next few minutes. Now is the time that we can attack because Iran is fully vulnerable. The Islamic Republic of Iran, it's time to hit, destroy the nuclear program.
So that was former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett speaking to CNN. And now let's go to another former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, speaking to CNN's Christian Amanpour, who asked Barak whether he agreed with the comments Bennett had made earlier.
In order to run a full-scale attempt to change the Middle East, we need all these alliances of blessing led by the United States. Israel is very strong. Israel cannot rearrange the Middle East on its own.
So that was former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. So your response, Nadim, to what they were saying?
Don't do it. Don't do it. You will fail. You failed in the past. I mean, we know that there is another pathway. Look, there are two central questions that as long as they're not resolved, the Middle East is not going to know peace. The first one is the Palestine question. And the second one is a question that has been central to the region since 1979, which is, what is the legitimate place of Iran? And by trying, since the 1980s, with the Iran-Iraq war, and since so many other conflicts since then, of trying to box in Iran and trying to sort of attack it, reduce its size, the only outcome has been Iran sort of pops back out from another door and uses non-state actors to establish its influence. It's done this in Lebanon with Hezbollah. It's done this in Iraq with the Shia militias. It's helped with the Houthis in Yemen. It's done this the same now in Syria. So I think we need to, in my view, if the region is to know proper peace, we need to answer these two questions. You know, either the Palestinians get a full independent state, a sovereign state, a la two-state solutions, which is what the Arab countries are pushing for, or they get full citizenship in one state, Jews and Arabs treated exactly the same. And you also, you know, that equation has to be resolved. Otherwise, and this is what October 7th reminded us, there can be no peace. There will be forms of armed resistance. Some you may like, some you may call terrorism, but there will be armed resistance as long as the Palestine question is not resolved in this region. And the second one as well, which is, and Iran has shown us that it can actually be very good at using patience. This is what it did after the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. And guess what? At the time, I remember a younger Netanyahu telling the Americans in Congress, it's all going to be fine. You know, Iran is going to lose. We're going to have democracy. Everyone's going to welcome us. Well, guess what? It didn't turn out exactly the same way. Yes, the U.S. had overwhelming power. Yes, the U.S. invaded and occupied Iraq. And the occupation was a disaster. And today, Iran is stronger than it ever was. So I'm not sure what Naftali Bennett hopes to achieve. And even Ehud Barak, which is trying to play more of a role of an elder statement. I've seen it. We have to be more cautious. But what he's saying is we have to be more cautious. So we need to make sure that the U.S. underwrites this whole enterprise. I think that would be foolish.
So let me ask you about that just before we end, Nadim. What are the prospects of the U.S. underwriting that plan, the potential for Israel to attack Iran?
Well, Look, to be honest, so far what we have seen is basically Team Biden equal Team Israel. You know, rhetorically they say, oh, we've asked Israel not to do this. We've told Israel this would be bad to do. And, you know, a few minutes later, we hear about new sales of weapons, billions of dollars being transferred, intel being provided. Right now, the U.S. is acting as a full enabler of Israel's, what I would consider not only aggressive, but actually extremely dangerous policies, which actually lead to Israel acting as a spoiled child of the U.S. and of the West, which leads it to take positions like indicating that and treating the had, you know, the Secretary General of the UN as persona non grata. Which, you know, rule of law country would do that?
And just to underscore what you're saying, Israel has said that the UN Secretary General Guterres cannot come to Israel, that he is persona non grata. Nadeem Houri, I want to thank you for joining us. Lebanese researcher, international lawyer, executive director of the Arab Reform Initiative, speaking to us from Paris, France. Coming up, we look at a new Fault Lines Al Jazeera documentary, Starving Gaza, in 20 seconds. True North by the Shondas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Gaza, where human rights experts say a deliberate man-made famine is underway. Last month, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food accused Israel of carrying out a starvation campaign in Gaza. A new documentary by Al Jazeera English's Fault Lines worked with Palestinian reporters to investigate how Israel has killed civilians seeking aid and attacked humanitarian networks in Gaza, and that the U.S. knows this is happening and has done nothing to stop it. In a minute, we'll be joined by the filmmaker. We begin with a clip from Starving Gaza and a warning. This contains graphic images and descriptions. In this clip, we hear from a Palestinian doctor, Ahmed Nasser, who's trying to save severely malnourished children in Kamal Adwan Hospital in Gaza.
I don't think anyone in North Gaza has enough food to eat. We have a new malnutrition case. The number of cases is beyond the malnutrition clinic's capacity.
Every day, the cries of hungry children fill the halls of Kamal Adwan Hospital in North Gaza. Some children here at the malnutrition clinic have never known a full meal in their lives. After the Hamas attacks on October 7th, Israel cut off fuel, food and water from Gaza. Within weeks, starvation had spread in the north. Israel doesn't allow foreign journalists into Gaza, so we worked with Palestinian reporters who filmed for us at Kamal Adwan Hospital in June.
How often does he have fever?
He had a high fever and diarrhea all night.
Abdulaziz is 5 months old and starving. Dr. Ahmed Nasser has been taking care of him with what little resources the hospital has on hand.
Should I be concerned? He had a fever for 20 days before I brought him to the hospital.
The situation is very serious. The child cannot absorb anything in his body. Anything that enters his body is excreted without benefit to him. His mother brought him to the hospital because the child was suffering from chronic diarrhea, vomiting, and high body temperature. Many times we were shocked to see 30 to 40 cases in one day for the same reason.
That's part of the opening to the new Fault Lines documentary, Starving Gaza. And this is another clip we hear from the parents of two-year-old Khaled, who died of malnutrition in February, an otherwise healthy toddler before Israel began its Gaza assault.
It's very difficult to lose your child because he was hungry. It's hard.
When famine starts, it takes the youngest first. It's been 5 months since Hanan Asaf and her husband Mohammed buried their two-year-old son, Khalid. This is Khalid in happier times, before the war on Gaza and the starvation that followed.
This war destroyed everything. Houses, people, trees, stones, everything was destroyed. This was my youngest son's room. The occupation forces burned it. They didn't leave us a single memory, nothing. The boy was fine. All of a sudden, he started to cry all the time. He began eating less because there was no food. He was used to drinking milk and eating rice and fruits. But since the beginning of the war, it decreased until it completely ran out. There was nothing available at all except for wild greens. And the prices are unbelievable for whatever is there. The boy looked like a skeleton. He was gone. He was completely gone. I would hold him like a newborn. He stopped being able to sit up, move, or walk. His body became very weak. I took him to Kamal Adwan Hospital. There was no medicine or treatment. On the last 2 days, he was on a ventilator.
Khalid died of severe dehydration and malnutrition at Kamal Adwan Hospital on February 2, 2024.
Starving Gaza. For more, we're joined in London by Hind Hassan, journalist, filmmaker, long covered Palestine and directed Starving Gaza for Fault Lines on Al Jazeera English. Welcome, Hind, to Democracy Now! This is a horrifying documentary. If you can start off by talking about these devastating effects of this last year on Gaza, and then we'll talk about the expose of the U.S. suppressing its own reports on preventing humanitarian aid from getting in, Israel doing that.
Thank you. And before I start doing that, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. But I just want to say that I am a documentary filmmaker. I'm a journalist. But this documentary was made by many people. The director, you know, was Mark, who works at Fault Lines at Al Jazeera, and all the other filmmakers that we had in Gaza. And their role is so central. And I think that's what makes this documentary so unique, is that collaboration that we had with the filmmakers who were inside Gaza so that they can showcase to the world the realities of what is happening in Gaza at the moment, and also show just how skilled they are and the conditions that they are working in, and yet they are still producing these incredibly powerful documentaries and films. But to your question, since October the 7th, we have seen the siege that already existed on Gaza increase. And as part of that, there has been a significant decrease in the amount of aid that has been able to get into Gaza. And as a result of that, we have seen a lot of children and women who are pregnant and newborns, toddlers and people suffering from malnutrition because they haven't been able to get access to the necessary food or the aid that is needed for them to be able to live a healthy life. And as a result of that, we have seen numerous cases of children who have died as a result of malnutrition. But the number of deaths just touches the reality on the ground and the number of people who are being impacted by what's happening. And this documentary, what it does is it speaks to the victims on the ground. It talks to those individuals who've lost their children, who have had to struggle with not being able to provide milk or formula or food, or have not been able, pregnant women who are not being able to provide the sustenance that babies need, doctors who are in the wards and who are trying to deal with the high number of victims that are coming in, with the patients that are coming in, showing you that day to day of what happens. And then also the search for accountability that you mentioned outside of Gaza, in the United States and in the United Kingdom. Because, of course, we as international journalists have not been able to get into Gaza since October the 7th. We have had to rely completely on our colleagues who are inside Gaza, who are not only working every single day, who don't have a break, who can't take a moment to try and gather themselves, but who have also been displaced, who have lost family members, who have been through incredible trauma of their own, but yet they are still documenting other people's trauma in order for us to understand the realities of what's happening on the ground. Because we haven't been able to go in and support our colleagues, we did what we could outside in order to support and showcase their work inside of Gaza.
And Hind, could you explain, I mean, you've said a little bit about this, how is it that you contacted people in Gaza, since, as you mentioned, Al Jazeera has not been there? Who were the filmmakers that you worked with?
So actually, I want to tell you a story about one of the filmmakers. We had many people who worked on the ground with us. We coordinated with people who were outside Gaza. It's a full Palestinian team. So there are people who are outside who help us coordinate inside. And then we also worked alongside cameramen, cinematographers and directors of photography who were inside Gaza. It's incredibly difficult. It's not easy to do because they are constantly dealing with a lack of data, lack of ability to be able to send footage over. The internet is very patchy and is very difficult. So communication is tough for us to be able to get in to communicate with them, let alone send that high quality footage over to us. And on top of that, they're dealing with daily bombardments and they're dealing with their own issues. But there is our director of photography who is inside Gaza. His name is Hussein Jaber. When I learnt about his story, I was completely shocked. And there's not much that shocks us journalists that work on these stories, because we see so many horrors and we hear the stories of people and what they've been through. But when I heard about our own colleague and what had happened to him, I was really blown away. It's a heartbreaking story. So on the 5th of December, Hussein Jaber had gone to Gaza City, where his family were. They had been ordered to evacuate by Israel, and so they were trying to head west, which is what they had been ordered to do. And he had been working. He'd gone to Gaza City in order to help his children evacuate. They had been staying in a building for a number of days, and then he sees his daughter running towards him, his youngest daughter, who's just 4 years old. Her name is Sanma, and as she's running to him, he describes the Israeli military firing bullets. It's sprayed everywhere. And he sees, as his daughter runs towards him, he sees his daughter shot in the neck. She's then still running somehow, slowly. She's writhing in pain. He runs towards her and he embraces her, and she dies. And this was our director of photography. This was not someone we featured in the documentary. This was the man who was filming that trauma. He watched his four-year-old die and be killed in the neck, just shot in the neck and killed just in December. Somehow his nine-year-old daughter, Sara, survived. She had a bullet that went through her jacket, but she managed to survive. And then his son, Amr, his three-year-old son, he says, is still asking, where is Selma? Where is my sister? And also, during that, as his daughter was shot, he was also here. He doesn't remember how it happened, when it happened, because it was all a blur and he was focused on his daughter. But he was also shot, and Al Jazeera did an interview with him, and there's a photograph of him on the Al Jazeera website where his arm is in a sling and he has external screws on his arm. This is the story of the Palestinian journalists in Gaza. So many of them have gone through this. They've been displaced. They've been injured. They've watched their own children die in front of them. And yet they somehow conjure the professionalism to pick up a camera and record and tell other people's trauma. And I think that's what is so powerful about this documentary. What's so unique about it is the way that we've tried to collaborate. This is a platform for them to tell their story. This is a platform for them to show the world what is happening to the children of Gaza, the impact of the lack of aid and the lack of food being able to get in. And it really is them center stage. And our role is to support them, is to be able to do that chasing and to do the accountability chasing. There is a moment in the film where I actually speak to Dr. Ahmed Nasser, and even during that, you don't see it on the documentary, you just see the moments that we managed to speak to him. But just during that communication, the line cut off maybe 5 or 6 times. And we had to keep calling back and we had to keep waiting. And the journalists who were filming on the other side, so Hussein Jaber and his colleagues, they were so patient. They were so professional. And I think as we look back, as we look back on these moments and these times and remember the journalists in Gaza, they really will be remembered in history as the titans of as journalists. And it's a complete honor for every single one of us that worked on this documentary to be able to say that we worked alongside them.
And let's remember that so many have been killed in the Israeli assault. Over the estimates are 170 journalists. Now, I want to go to it's the film is sort of in two parts, and then it's responsibility for what's happening in Gaza. This is a clip from Starving Gaza that features Stacey Gilbert. She's former senior advisor in the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, resigned after over 20 years after disagreements with how the State Department put out the report that she worked on that concluded that Israel was not obstructing U.S. humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Not her conclusion.
It is widely known and documented in the humanitarian community and the U.S. government that Israel has been blocking humanitarian assistance since the start of the Gaza conflict.
Stacey Gilbert was a senior officer in the U.S. State Department and specialized in humanitarian assistance. She resigned in May after the Biden administration concluded Israel isn't blocking aid.
They have made a policy decision to support Israel unconditionally.
What are those specific ways of aid being blocked?
It's everything. There are administrative obstacles, not enough customs officials checking these items. The food that goes bad because it's waiting on the trucks. So it's like a spigot. They turn on, they turn off. They decide that some things can't go in, other things can. Aid workers' visas are denied or delayed. And when the pressure builds, they will allow more assistance in. But then the spigot gets turned off again. So Israel and the United States government will say, look, some assistance is going in. It's never been enough. And they know that.
The U.S. gives Israel billions of dollars in security funding each year. There's a U.S. law that prohibits arms transfers to countries that are blocking humanitarian assistance.
The administration deliberately denies the facts on the ground because it would trigger consequences to cut off security funding. It allows the weapons sales to continue. The weapons are the engine that fuel this war, and we are not taking responsibility for our role in it.
So that was Stacey Gilbert, former senior advisor in the State Department, who resigned. Hind Hassan, this is another clip from your report, Starving Gaza, when you come to Washington and question State Department spokesperson Matt Miller.
We went to a press briefing at the U.S. State Department to ask about Washington's support for Israel as famine has spread throughout Gaza. We've had aid organizations and relief groups who've said over and over again that Israel is using starvation as a tactic of war. How do you respond to the allegations of complicity of the U.S. government? And what more will it take for the U.S. to stop Israeli military funding?
So is the United States that has secured all of the major agreements to get more humanitarian assistance into Gaza. Going back to the very early days, the first week after October 7th, when the secretary traveled to the region and the president traveled to Israel, and together convinced Israel to open Rafah crossing to allow humanitarian assistance in. It has not been enough. There are obstacles. Sometimes those are logistical obstacles coming from Israel. Sometimes those are the nature of moving humanitarian assistance around in an armed conflict.
Under U.S. law, it is required that any country receiving military support must not obstruct the flow of humanitarian aid during war. And every major rights group, from the United Nations to Human Rights Watch, has said that Israel is using starvation as a tactic of war. Do you disagree with them? And are you just, sorry, one final question, are you not afraid
of completely losing legitimacy, of being seen as being hypocritical when it comes to supporting human rights in one country, but not when it comes to Palestinians.
Let me just answer the first question. So I would encourage you to read the report that we issued on this very question 2 months ago that looked into Israel's compliance with international humanitarian law and their work and whether they had done a good enough job to let humanitarian assistance in, where we said that there were some roadblocks that needed to be overcome, and we had worked to overcome those, and we had seen Israel take steps to allow humanitarian assistance in.
So that's State Department spokesperson Matt Miller and Hassan questioning him in Washington, D.C. Coming out of the Stacey Gilbert clip from the film, who quit the State Department over the report that was issued, and ProPublica recently revealed that USAID and the State Department's Refugees Bureau, where she worked, both concluded this spring that Israel had deliberately blocked deliveries of food and medicine into Gaza, but U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other top Biden officials rejected the findings of the agencies. Blinken's decision allowed the U.S. to keep sending arms to Israel. Your final thoughts, Hind?
So, as you saw there, two very contrasting statements. You have the former State Department official saying that Israel is deliberately blocking aid. And then you have Matt Miller saying, oh, please check out our report. Israel could do more, but they're not deliberately blocking aid. And to understand this, you really have to understand Stacey Gilbert and her role and who she is. She has worked for the State Department for many, many years. She's been doing this job for decades. And this decision may have been an easy decision for her, but it's not one that she took lightly. She's worked in so many other countries. So for her, at this point, to decide, I cannot continue in my job, I must step down because of this, shows you how huge that is, that opinion is to her, or what's happened it is to her. And so I really don't think that you can take lightly what she's done or any of the other officials who have resigned. I was born in Iraq, and I remember watching all the resignations of the officials in the United States who did not support the war in Iraq or the invasion for legality reasons. And so it's full circle now to have been sat in front of Stacey Gilbert and to hear her say that she is haunted by that report, and that the reason why she resigned was because she wants to be an asterisk in the history books, that she didn't stay quiet and that she spoke up. And so I think viewers can watch this documentary and they can make up their own minds, but there is a huge body of evidence which suggests that Israel has been purposefully blocking the flow of aid into Gaza, and that the United States government knows about it.
Hind Hassan, we thank you so much for being with us. Journalist, documentary filmmaker, has long covered Palestine, is the correspondent and narrator on the new Al Jazeera documentary film, Starving Gaza, worked with many Palestinian filmmakers in Gaza. Coming up, the death toll from Hurricane Helene nears 200 as we look at six plastic factory workers feared dead after floodwater swelled around their Tennessee workplace. Their boss repeatedly threatened to fire anyone who left during the storm back in 20 seconds.
Shadows are falling and I'm running out of breath. Keep me in your heart for a while. If I leave you, it doesn't mean I love you any less. Keep me in your heart for a while. When you get up in the morning and you see that crazy sun, keep me in your heart for a while. There's a train leaving nightly called when all is said and done. Keep me in your heart for a while.
Keep me in your heart by Warren Zevon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We look now at the impact of Hurricane Helene. Power outages and water shortages continue across six southeastern states. The death toll from the storm is nearing 200, with hundreds more still missing and presumed dead. This includes six plastic factory workers in Erwin, Tennessee, who were swept away as floodwaters swelled around their workplace after their boss reportedly threatened to fire anyone who left during the storm. This is the family of an Impact Plastics worker named Lydia Verdugo.
She was still working when she called me, and she told me that it was really raining. And I told her to leave, but she told me they weren't telling her anything.
If they would have told them to leave earlier, maybe we would be here. They would still be here today, and we wouldn't be looking for them. But when they tried to leave, it was too late.
The Tennessee Bureau of Investigations investigating how some workers said Impact Plastics threatened to fire anyone who left ahead of the storm. This is Robert Jarvis, one of the survivors.
What would you say to the company?
Why'd you make us work that day? Why? We shouldn't have worked. We shouldn't have been there. None of us should have been there. And that's what I should have said to them.
Impact Plastics said Monday in a statement it had monitored weather conditions during the storm and that managers had dismissed workers, quote, when water began to cover the parking lot and the adjacent service road and the plant lost power, unquote. For more, we're joined by Cesar Bautista, campaign director at the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition, has been working in Erwin, Tennessee, to assist with relief efforts after Hurricane Helene. Cesar, welcome to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes. Can you explain what happened? This plastics factory is right next to a river. What were they told? Why were they so afraid they'd be fired if they didn't come to work?
Yes. Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, so a lot of the family members, you know, expressed just like on the clip that you showed that, you know, they were told, like, not to leave yet, that, you know, they were still asking questions, like, you know, should we leave or not so forth. They kept going back and forth, I believe, with one of the secretaries at the office. But as they were trying to get answers, they were noticing that the water was getting higher and higher, like in the parking lot area. And, you know, once like the factory did make the decision of telling people, OK, you can go, it was just too late. And the water had rise too high to the point that they couldn't move their cars anymore and try to get to safety.
And so what are you calling for, Cesar? You're obviously advocating on the rights of these workers. What are you calling for?
Well, you know, in these moments right now, it's very difficult, you know, and we are standing in solidarity with all the families that they lost a loved one. Most importantly, what we're calling is just to be sure that there's equitable access to the recovery plan that the city and the state have initiated. So just making sure, you know, that there's no language barriers, that everybody has the equal amount of access, you know, to any kind of resources that are being provided, just to be sure that the families, you know, have what they need to in order to rebuild their lives after this hurricane.
So talk about how typical this was. Now, again, to emphasize, Impact Plastics said at no time were employees told they would be fired if they left the facility. But if you can overall talk about the fear of migrant workers, and also we're talking about a vast area of six states right now. You work with the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition. We don't really know how many people have died, close to 200 at this point, quantified, but hundreds more missing. And where are people going for refuge?
You know, so here in Erwin, Tennessee, a lot of people right now have been going to the county high school for any kind of refuge or resources that they're looking for. That has been a great source. Also, the local church, one of the local churches, St. Michael, has been, you know, just a great supporter for the community to gather, to mourn, to, you know, just really process everything that has been happening. And so that has been, you know, what where people have been going mainly, you know, just to try to find some comfort and support with the community. I would say too, you know, that the community overall has shown they've come up as a unified form, you know, just like to really support each other and, you know, just to keep each other together throughout this, you know, tough process right now.
And the understanding about climate change for many immigrants, one of the reasons they came to this country fleeing the devastation of climate change in their country and then dealing with it today here. All the reports are saying the intensification, the rapidity with which this storm intensified due to climate change.
Right. And so, you know, with climate change, as we see this, you know, this is starting to be more of a pattern now. Here in Tennessee, you know, we had the hurricane, you know, just a couple of days ago. Last December, we had a tornado go through Nashville, Tennessee, and then 2 years before that, there was another tornado. And so we've noticed that, you know, this is starting to become a pattern. And so what really we're urging, you know, our municipalities and like in the state, you know, not just in Tennessee, but across the country, is that they have to have like, you know, those evacuation plans, you know, for like, you know, for each city, but also now, you know, for each company that, you know, has like, you know, like all these workers there in order to be sure that people are safe, but also to set up an infrastructure where everybody has equitable access, you know, for
Cesar
the recovery.
Bautista, we're going to have to leave it there. Campaign director at the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition in Irwin, Tennessee. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Queens alumni, homecoming is just a week away. Get ready for a weekend packed with fun, memories, and excitement. Whether you're looking to reconnect, celebrate, or just enjoy the festivities, there's something for everyone. Don't miss out. Find out all the details and